Sometimes you just feel like you have flies in the brain, you know? I'm not sure what it is. Hey, this is Adam Gamo for This Anthro Life. I'm joined again by guest host Andrea Eller, and we are continuing our conversation with biological anthropologist Julie Lesnick. This time we're going prehistoric. We're looking at some of the evidence in the fossil record, as well as some behavioral and comparative research we can do with chimpanzees and gorillas to understand how bugs have fit into the diets of humans and our closest cousins, and what this means for how we evolved over time. And if you want to follow along, we've got some discussion questions, a new thing we're trying here on This Anthro Life. You can check it out at thisanthrolife.com/insects. We've got questions from episodes 2 and 3, talking with Julie Lesnick, so you can follow along if you're in a class, working with students, or just want some, you know, tasty dinner conversation. Check it out. Let us know what you think.
And I've thought about, I think a big part of it too is like insect-based protein or insect-based foods is a wonderful kind of resource to be used in areas of the world where food security is a real issue. And so then you think of like an aid program coming in and being like, here, we're going to bring you foods. And so insects would be a wonderful thing to be like, here, but then be like, but we don't eat it, you know? And so it's like, that's not going to go well. So even in just that scenario, like if we can just make it to where it is something that's okay here, then it is something that can be used to set up kind of cultivated, you know, cricket farms in these areas that are food insecure. But to push something on people that we don't do ourselves, like that's insulting. And so I think that is a big part of, like, I think of this as such a global issue. Like our, you know, decisions and our biases here are so globally, you know, taken. Like it's not just us. And so that's where I'm like, not everybody has to eat bugs, but we got to get okay with the fact that people do eat bugs.
I agree with you. That seems like a great place to start. And it starts by asking these kinds of questions, as your work does, you know, that this is not actually a new idea. It's perhaps an incredibly old idea that we lost at some point. And, you know, perhaps the time is now for these issues to think about gaining it back.
Yeah, and I think so. It's like, very much not the first person to ever be like, you know, early humans ate bugs, but it only is ever like, that's about as much as is ever said, like, oh, the hominid diet probably included bugs. And then the end, move on to, you know, talking about hunting. And so one of the things that happened that kind of allowed me to do this work is, you know, I am a paleoanthropologist. I mean, that's where my work starts. And so there are these bone tools in South Africa that were found, I think in the 70s is when they were first discovered, but it was in 2001 that researchers did some experiments with their own kind of, you know, they made their own bone tools and they did experiments on what these tools were used for. And they happened to use digging into termite mounds as one of those experiments. And that was the best match for these bone tools. That we have the artifacts, the 1.7 million year old ones from South Africa. And so that's the moment that that's what I leveraged. Like that's how I could all of a sudden bring insects into a much more prominent, you know, spot in thinking about insects as food, is because in paleo, if we don't have the evidence, it's then just like a just so story. And a lot of the work I do is theoretical. But because we have some actual evidence, it's more than a just-so story. And so that was the opportunity that I saw and I had in paleo. And then it's allowed me to then talk about bugs, you know, as an actual food source for humans, you know, and then thinking about it today and looking at the patterns around the world.
So talk to us more about these tools, because I thought that they were a really fascinating piece of your work. And for people who don't know what an insect tool might look like or be, because I think we're talking now about insects that we haven't yet brought up, right? Ones that Westerners might not be thinking as much about, or certainly not as a food source.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the bone tools, I liken them to about the size of a Sharpie. So if you had a Sharpie marker.
I know how big a Sharpie marker is. I got
yeah.
that.
Yeah. So if you have a Sharpie marker and like that's about what you'd be holding in your hand. Maybe the big fat Sharpie, you know, sometimes, but that's about what you're dealing with. And so what we see in them, why they're artifacts, is because one end of this just bone fragment is polished and worn in such a way that it's smooth and rounded. And so we find lots of bone fragments all the time in the fossil record. Like fragmentary is the name of the game. But what makes these bone fragments stand out and unique was the fact that there's 100 of them across multiple sites in South Africa that have this wear and polish. And so that's how we know they were digging implements. And so when they were first published, that's what they were digging implements. And it was thought that maybe they were digging for tubers, to get kind of the energy storage organ of plants, and you just kind of dig into the ground, you get those bulbs. And so that was sort of the original hypothesis, but it was not tested beyond like these are digging tools, and we dug for tubers and they kind of look like the artifacts. So it was in 2001 that the researchers were like, well, let's see if we can refine that. Like, does the microscopic wear pattern on the ends of these artifacts actually preserve sort of the action that the tool was used in, as well as sort of the substrate that it was used to dig into? And so they looked at digging for tubers. Now, if you dig for tubers in South Africa, you're going to hit a lot of the limestone, just chunks. So you end up getting a lot of kind of scars on the end of the tool if you're digging just straight into the ground. But digging into a termite mound, the soil is very finely sorted because it was carried there by termites, and they're little. They can, they're not carrying big rocks. And so you don't get those heavy rock inclusions. And so that's what they were seeing on the experimental tools, is that digging into the termite mounds, the striations were a lot more parallel. They were narrower. They had a lot less of those large scars. And that was the most prominent pattern preserved in the artifacts. So there are 100 of them or so. So they are variable. They're not all perfectly termite matching, but the most kind of dominant pattern was best match for termites. And the other thing I sometimes say is like, if somebody tomorrow did an experiment on those tools, or they had a time machine and they were like, those tools never touched a termite mound, I wouldn't care, because it allowed me to do the work I've done. And I think it's important whether or not those tools were used to actually dig into a termite mound or not, because what we know is that most of the tools used to dig into termite mounds are perishable and don't preserve. So a stick and a rock work better. Actually, I think I have a paper out from 2006 that showed that if I was going to dig for termites, I'd grab the rock, not a bone fragment. But those bone fragments were probably just such a multi-purpose tool, and they were carried around and used for everything. And so digging into termite mounds was one of those things.
Okay, good. So it sounds like you've got some real life experience for this one, because, myself personally, I've never fished for termites in a mound or dug in a termite mound for food or for pleasure, being honest. So can you describe to me a little bit more of like, what's a termite mound and how big are they maybe? And like, how would one dig? Do you get like a chair or like a shovel or a stick? What am I going for?
So the termite genus that is consumed the most by both humans and then also chimpanzees is Macrotermes. And Macrotermes, now there's a lot of species of them, but Macrotermes make the mounds that you might have seen on travel shows, like across the African savanna, those huge giant mounds. Those are...
Okay, yeah, I'm with you.
Not,
like as tall as I am, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, they are easily human height or taller.
I'm tall. I'm
tall.
A tall person.
They can be even taller. But not all the species make them quite that big, but that is the genus. And so they can range from, 8 feet high to, 4 feet high. They can also be low and kind of cover a large, area. Like instead of being a small footprint that goes really tall, they can be a low footprint that doesn't go as tall. They can also just be entirely subterranean. So you might not actually see a mound. And instead all the tunnels are just under you. So that's the one thing. And that's the tough thing, but the interesting thing about this work is that how variable insects are in that regard. But thinking about what chimpanzees do, because they're very well known to use tools to forage for termites. So this was, you know, a discovery that Jane Goodall made when she was first studying chimpanzees. And now it's been confirmed, you know, for many different sites, chimps use tools to get termites out of the mound. And so what chimps do is they don't actually dig into the mound. Chimpanzees instead use just the small, narrow passages that are naturally there that the termites built. So they're exit holes. And chimps will take a small piece of vegetation, either strip it from a big leaf or a piece of grass or whatever is nearby, but a flexible piece of vegetation that they can thread into that hole. So the cool thing here is that these termites, the macrotermites, the soldier caste is what's going to defend the mound. And soldiers and termites have lots of different defense mechanisms. If you look across all of the termites, so some can spit like chemical defensive, like glue, sticky toxins. But then some have, and those don't taste good.
Noted.
I imagine.
Yeah, no, indeed.
Those are not the termites that chimps eat or people eat. But the termites they do eat are ones that have a more mechanical defense mechanism. They have biting pinchers. They have, you know, mandibles that cut and slice. And the thing with the soldier caste is that, you know, in a caste system of insects, whether it's honeybees or these termites, is that the only one reproducing is the queen. And everybody else there is there to just make sure that the queen can do her, you know, important job of having babies. So these soldiers are actually dispensable. Like if a soldier dies, it's not the same as an individual in a, you know, kind of a, like a population of mammals dying, because like you didn't stop that individual from contributing genes to the next generation. They were never going to. And so that means that they can, that their lives are a little bit more, you know, expendable. And so what they do is they bite and they don't let go, knowing that what they bite is probably going to drag them out of the mound and they'll never come back, but it's their job to go down fighting. And so chimpanzees use that to their advantage. They thread in this blade of grass, the soldiers bite and don't let go, which allows the chimps to drag them out of the mound. And then for the most part, the chimps aren't even at risk for being bitten because the termites are biting the tool. And so then the chimps can just kind of slide that tool through their mouth and get the termites off of it. So that's the most basic method of foraging for termites.
Hmm. That sounds nice. You know, it's a smart way to do it.
Yeah, it's really elegant. And the kind of cool thing is that humans don't do it any better. Like there's not much, like there isn't really a better way to do it than to let the soldiers bite and to pull them out of the mound. So what humans will do is dig a hole into the top of the mound. So if, you know, in the kind of populations that I've worked with is that, you know, you grab a bucket and a shovel and you go and you dig a big hole in the top of the mound. But then what you do is you grab the natural vegetation around you and you make a natural broom. Hmm. So now instead of sliding one piece of grass in, you can dip 20 pieces of grass in. And so you've increased the surface area. And now all those soldiers are going to attack that broom. You take that broom. Some people dunk it into water, and the water, I think, ultimately makes them release. Or you can just kind of run your hand down the broom and, you know, just knock them off into the bucket. And then the bucket will have, like, you know, it's a plastic bucket, so it's slick on the sides, and the termites can't climb out. And then you have a big bucket of termites to take home.
That's also very clever. That's also so how would the sticks have figured in? Because you said it's about the size of a thick Sharpie, so not long enough for a fishing tool. So maybe more like a shovel?
So I think they're, you know, a small hand shovel. You could dig a big hole, you know, to dip a broom into. But actually, what I think that the tools would most logically, just from me, you know, going out and collecting enough termite samples, is that because I don't want to disturb the mound, I don't want to put a giant hole in the top of the mound. So when I'm like collecting samples for nutritional or chemical analyses, so I actually use chimpanzee methods. I just, you know, slide in one piece of grass into an already existing hole. But the termites cover those passages. That's the workers' jobs. So the workers will come and seal those passages so that, you know, you can't come in, basically so ants can't come in and take over the mound. And so what I do when I'm in the field is I have my trowel, actually from archaeology, but I take my trowel and I just kind of clear off a surface. And then when, by cleaning off the surface, just an inch or two, I then now have all these holes much more exposed. I can see them much better. And my grass tool slides in much better. So there's a very good chance that these digging tools weren't digging huge holes. Instead, they were just kind of manipulating the surface so they could get to those passages more easily.
Interesting.
Yeah, so that is super interesting. And I'm kind of thinking about, so, you know, kind of tracing this, because you mentioned a little bit ago that some of the earliest tool fossil evidence that we have is from like 1.7 million years, which of course is before Homo sapiens were around, right? This is like the Australopithecine era. And so, you know, what, if we think of, like, again, this broad view, I think is super fascinating, like how, you know, we're seeing sort of the consumption of insects, which is called entomophagy. I can't even say that word very well. You know, so we're seeing evidence of this, you know, pre-Homo sapien into Homo sapiens. So I think I'm really fascinated by the comparison of using one experimental archaeology as a way to, you know, use contemporary tools or contemporary practices that, like, you know, mimic, you know, some of the either tool use or like the methods that you know, Australopithecines or Pisistines or Homo erectus would have used, or maybe even, you know, early Homo sapiens. So I guess, like, how does this help us think about human evolution, right? Because so obviously we're knowing that insects, in this case, by following your lines of evidence here, that there are insects that have been part of the diet of both sapiens and before sapiens and the human family bush, as it were. You know, and like also thinking about chimpanzees too. So I really appreciate the way that you kind of bring together multiple lines of evidence, right? Looking at tools and then testing them experimentally, as well as in looking at our neighbors, the chimpanzees, and also looking at modern forager groups too, and your own research too, of looking at how you also will dig. And so it's like, I guess, like, what kind of picture does this paint? Because I think one of the other pieces that's interesting, thinking about like Homo erectus and Australopithecines, like in Africa versus, for example, Neanderthals that came later, they're in a different part of the world, right? And so I think this harkens back to this question of latitudes, right? That we know insects are in certain places. And so we may probably, you know, don't have the same kind of evidence of Neanderthals eating insects that we would have in Olduvai Gorge, for example, right?
Right. So yeah, the bone tools are definitely like an Australopithecine tool. And so in kind of reconstructing what the insect portion of that Australopithecine diet looked like is really a focus on those social insects, because that's what chimpanzees eat. So chimpanzees use tools for termites. They use tools for ants as well. They can dip, you know, a stick into an ant trail and then eat the ants. And they also will use tools to open up nests of bees for honey. And so chimpanzees, the insects they eat are these social insects that when you go there, the payoff is very big. But we know that people today eat all sorts of insects. There's over 2,000 known insect species that are consumed today, I think. And so in thinking about that transition, what needs to happen, like capability, technology wise, to make it worth your time to go after insects that are solitary? What is that? What innovation do you really need? And this is where, you know, thinking about foraging populations. So thinking about maybe this transition happened with Homo erectus. And when I reconstruct Homo erectus past, I'm looking more for, you know, at modern foragers. And if I'm thinking of women and how they go out and collect insects, you know, in these groups, they have something to put them in. And so again, now I'm talking about another tool that's not going to preserve, but just a simple basket or any carrying container is all you really need to take advantage of grabbing grasshoppers while you're out foraging and bringing them back. And so, because at the Australopithecine or chimpanzee level, that you sit and you eat at that mound. But with Homo erectus, we're starting to have evidence of home bases, that they did come together collectively. And so if they're coming together collectively, they're probably dividing some of the efforts. And it's not saying that like full on, you know, sexual division of labor necessarily was going on, and not definitely not in like the ways that we might think about it. but they were coming together. And so they were probably gathering food and bringing it back there, even if they were only going to eat it themselves. But there was protection in that group, you know, because humans, you know, Australopithecines, Homo erectus, humans, when you're out there without our modern weapons, like, we can still be prey to predators. There are still risks out there. And so to get back to camp quickly and be back in your group where you could mob a potential, you know, large cat or something that was coming after you, would be important and helpful and useful. And so just a simple basket, simple, you know, carrying container allows you to transition to a new food resource.
Hmm. And the foraging practices would have taken advantage, because if you had a home base, or even were moving around, you know, your home base moved some, but within sort of one ecology type or similar habitat types, I could imagine that, like collecting seasonal fruit or other resources, tubers or fungus or lichens or shellfish, that with some experience of the land, you could anticipate where these resources are likely to be. So you could make relatively efficient trips of going to, right, a particular fallen log or a particular coastline or a particular, you know, underbush that is likely to have, you know, known resources. And that seems to me, so, you know, with your carrying capacity, do we have any evidence of any baskets, or is this kind of the, those don't preserve well because they're made out of grasses problem?
Yeah, they don't preserve, at least at the age that I care about, you know, so there are baskets preserved, but they're going to be, you know, they're going to be up in Europe where things preserve better because the climate is much more conducive to that. And so then it's going to be much more recent in human evolution because, you know, Homo erectus didn't leave Africa until, you know, 1.5 million years ago or so. And I think I kind of, I skipped another thing that Adam had kind of brought up, was the sort of environment. And so the thing with Homo erectus is that when Homo erectus left Africa, let's say they have these baskets and they're collecting insects, they stayed primarily in the tropics still. Like they then headed to Southeast Asia. At least the majority of sites are still largely tropical, even for Homo erectus. And so it is, it's post Homo erectus, it's Homo sapiens, it's Neanderthals that are then up in the, you know, the really cold environments, exclusive, you know, that they're the only ones up there. Of course, modern humans were throughout Africa and Southeast Asia as well. And so that environment, that tropical environment, because humans were there for the majority of our existence, you know, thinking of our diets as an adapted to a tropical environment makes the most sense.
I'm thinking, if I had a basket and it was my job to go out and gather some stuff
eat. To go where you know they are. Absolutely.
And I don't know that I would only go after one thing.
Right.
Like, if my job is to go out there, I think I would gather just about anything I thought I could eat or that anyone could eat. And it could be plants, it could be, you know, potentially small animals or shellfish or fruit or insects or all of it, depending on how lucky or what time of year it was. And so from the evidentiary, you know, how would I even prove today what somebody puts in a basket? You know what I'm saying? So just because you had a basket, even if you could show it, you know, this is some of the problems with reconstructing paleo environments and why it's so great that your work uses these integrated approaches, as Adam brought up earlier, and as I know you know, are important aspects of ways to do more than just tell a gesso story, right? The technology is plausible, that makes sense, but it's really hard to evidence specifically. And that's just always a problem with paleoanthropological studies, in my opinion.
Yeah, of course. And that's where, like, you know, really relying on these models that we can create from modern foragers is super critical. And, you know, the number one consumed insect worldwide is actually beetle larva, palm weevil larva. And they're pretty big. They're like 2 inches and fat. And I've never had them, and it will be hard for me the first time, and I'm gonna have to, like, I'm not gonna be able to say no the first time they're offered to me. And but those are actually to the point where they're semi-cultivated, because those beetles lay their eggs in palm branches that are on the ground, so dead branches of palm trees. And so when people go out and collect, you know, other parts of the palm for other, you know, the other resources, whether it's palm hearts or the leaves to do something, if they leave a branch on the ground, they can calculate a certain number of weeks later, there's probably going to be larvae in that branch. And so you know where to go because you were already there and you created the habitat that's just right for these beetles to come and lay their eggs. And so that is actually the number one consumed bug around the world. And it's that because it's semi-cultivated. And so that's the beauty of social insects, is like you can spot a termite mound and you can go back to it every day. And there's millions of insects in there and it's going to keep producing. And same with the semi-cultivated kind of beetle larva, is that the payoff is actually pretty big because you find the whole, you know, brood of the larva. So all of the eggs that hatched. And so having those places that, you know, offer big payoffs are where people are going to keep going back to. So it isn't, you know, just to collect everything that's edible. It's a go to where you know what is reliable, and you're going to have your favorite things. And maybe you show up to that termite mound and those termites are hiding that day because they aren't always super active. So the temperature can be such, or, you know, they're more active in the rainy season. So if it's been dry for so long, they might not be as active. And so your termites aren't available. So then you go and you check out, you know, your second favorite food source.
It makes so much sense. And I mean, because of the insect diversity, because of the seasonally available nature or, you know, risky nature of catching any game or food source, that there's just a lot of temporal and technological variability. But it also is going to explain why we wouldn't expect there to have been a single moment in time where somebody went, wait, I know how to do this. Or that if there was, that moment in time happened a bunch of times.
Yeah.
In bunch of different parts of the world. And so, you know, you talk about in your book that you also see that kind of diversity even among non-human primates, modern non-human primates. That yes, the chimps have the termite tools and the mounds, but that there are other primates, all tropical animals, who are taking advantage of lots of other insects and the diversity with which they do that. In addition to the modern human examples, kind of show what diversity is possible and the idea that there probably isn't just one evolutionary lineage we were all following along that is, you know, insectivory, but is something much more nuanced. Is that a good summary of it?
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, I think it's a great way of putting it that, you know, primate species across the board, you know, some eat bugs, some don't. Some eat more bugs, some eat less. They eat certain bugs, but not others. And that's true for people too. And actually going back to the stigma, one thing I like to point out, and I should probably, again, similar to the like number of bugs that makes a burger, I need to get the actual fact and reference down so I can cite a specific occurrence. But basically you can have a population in Africa that termites are a huge part of their diet, but they judge the people next door to them who eat grasshoppers and not termites.
Oh,
right. So, you know, othering
classic
is,
human nature.
Yeah, like othering is classic human nature.
We're jerks.
So, like, we might be the worst at it, but like,
only to other people.
So it's all very sort of it's population specific, and so yes, it's the environment, but it's also, you know, just what works. Like if you just didn't eat termites, but you eat grasshoppers and you're doing good, you don't need termites, you know? So everybody just kind of fits their niches how they do. And then that kind of gets culturally passed on to the next generation and they repeat what worked for their parents and they repeat what worked for their parents. And they don't necessarily always explore these other food resources, and they might stigmatize those that do use those resources. So we see it in people. Primates are going to have variation depending on who you're looking at and where. But one of the fun sort of thought exercises that I've enjoyed, and I need to like think more on it and figure out if there's actual sort of ways to build models and test them, is thinking about the New World in regards to humans. So thinking about the population, the peopling of the Americas, is if they came over Beringia, and yes, there's probably multiple paths and blah, 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 but if the primary way that the majority of people in the first wave of population, you know, of populating the, you know, these continents came through Beringia, then those were non-insect eating people. But insect eating in the tropics in the Americas is just as common as insect eating in the tropics everywhere else. And so it would have had to have been rediscovered. Like, these people would have had to migrate all the way down from Canada through North America into Mexico and then discovered, hey, these grasshoppers make a really good food resource, and have to kind of independently develop the technology and the methods and the cultures around utilizing them as food.
Yes. And in each case, as you said, you know, there would have to be reason to have a cultivation or an infrastructure. Different groups had home bases at different rates, and perhaps not even always at, you know, not even all year, perhaps. Perhaps there was movement, then there was more home base. Can I ask, do you know of any agricultural model of insect cultivation in human history?
So
I guess, yeah, writ large.
So meaning like insects as livestock cultivation?
Yes.
I do not know what the earliest would be. Most of the insect eating that isn't wild forage, that fits more of like an agricultural model, comes from collecting the insects out of your agricultural plot because they're pests. And so if those grasshoppers are going to kill your crops, but then you collect those grasshoppers, you just reduced your pests and you just got yourself a protein source.
Ooh, that's good thinking. That's double food right there.
Yeah, it is. And that's right. That's seen across continents. It's seen in Mexico. It's seen it's seen in Central America. It's seen in Africa. It's seen in Southeast Asia. Like, that is how you farm, you know, is you got to get rid of those pests and their food. So don't destroy your food. You know, it's a valuable food source. Eat that food. So now, yeah, you doubly cultivated in that one plot of land. You have a complete meal.
Whatever crop you are cultivating becomes the attraction for the insects. That's the trap for your other food source. And so it becomes a completion. Well, doesn't that just make a lot of sense?
Yeah. when I started kind of digging into, when I started really getting into, you know, edible insect research beyond the paleo and beyond chimpanzees, it was this idea that the reason we don't eat insects here is because with agriculture, insects became pests, and then we started stigmatizing them. And I was like, wait a minute, the world is agricultural. Like, let's not pretend that this is just something
we invented this. Yeah. Yes.
And so then I started looking at how people eat bugs, you know, in non-foraging societies, like people that have crops and use markets and they just collect the bugs that are there with their crops. So it's pest management. So it's much smarter than, you know, I think people really would give them credit for.
Okay, Julia, I think we just found your in. What if you convince the urban farmers of today to eat their compost worms after a while? Now, I realize worms
that sounds
exactly
good.
Bugs, but, you know, there's got to be something, there's a there, you know what I mean?
The compost worms might work. The problem when you first started saying that, I was thinking of the grasshoppers, you know, and such. And the problem is wild foraging here is not really safe, because your little plot of land might not have pesticides in it, might not have toxic runoff, but you don't really know where that grasshopper was before it got to you. And then similar, like with those worms that are composting, like if you had a complete controlled system where you knew exactly what those worms were eating, you know, maybe this could work, but they are also somewhat mobile and there might be runoff into the ground that they are, you know, are collecting metals or toxins or something that we should not be eating. So it's hard to wild forage insects in the United States. I always caution. People do. Sometimes I compare it to mushroom hunting. Like, you just got to be really smart to not get the ones that, you know, are poisonous. But also, like, you want to make sure you're in a very remote area so that these insects aren't collecting these toxins.
Okay, so just to be clear, we are not supporting urban insect wild foraging.
Yeah, I don't think that's okay.
Urban foraging sounds dangerous in any regard.
And yes, exactly.
Well, I mean, dumpster diving, come on now. There's a little bit of, hey, I am not the only one on this phone call. Who has dumpster dive? Don't pretend, people.
We're just saying be careful.
Yeah, those expiration dates. That's just a suggestion. slash conspiracy.
Yes.
Okay, for everyone out there, right, no wild insect foraging. But what about the compost worms? If the compost worms are grade A and I put them in my compost bin and I'm the one that turns them over and only feeds them food that I otherwise was eating,
in theory,
I could eat the worms too?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's kind of then similar to like at-home cricket farms or at-home mealworm farms, which are wonderful because you feed them your food scraps. And so like you chop up carrots, you cut off the top, you give it to your crickets. And so then like, you didn't even have to like buy food for those insects and then you get to eat the insects.
You know, Andrea, this is making me think if we return to our idea of the hipster cockroach food truck, if it were to follow us around, if we put like a little, you know, cricket farm on the back of it and we just put the food scraps there, we could like feed twice as many people.
You know, that's a great idea. That's a really good thing to, because it completes the cycle. It somehow makes it even more sustainable than it was before. And I have to say, going back to your point about it not, you know, early on, you were saying that you've only sampled bugs, and it's not so much that you're not committed to the cause, even though you've had your own ups and down challenges with disgust and things, but that it's not fully incorporated. And you know, in the course of us doing this episode or these episodes, I went to a downtown DC restaurant, Oyamel. It's a Mexican restaurant, and they had a Oaxacan dish, a Oaxacan taco that had crickets in it on the menu. It was regular, and I was ready to order it, and it was not available.
Oh, no.
And I was like, oh no, I was all ready to do this, and why not? And the server informed me that now this was during the federal shutdown, but of many of the issues that are happening at the border, the Mexican-U.S. border these days, cricket deliveries are being hurt, and we can't get the supply over the border. So just, yeah, I absolutely, to the infrastructure point that, you know, having at-home versions or being able to think about farming locally, and I agree, not as an additional thing that you have to do, but that insects are going to be naturally attracted. In fact, we know they are naturally attracted to the things that we are doing anyway. Mm-hmm. So if we can incorporate them as part of an ecological cycle that we're already doing, even if it's just simply to have an at-home farm of them, you know, I think that that's a great way to think about it, because otherwise, right, I mean, importing them from Mexico, all right, you know, I'm not opposed to that, but like with all foods, like with the fruits, you know, like we're going to have more sustainability if you're able to recognize that anything we can source locally, using technology or just using the locally available resources, both, is going to cut the amount of energy we put in to shipping food around the world, which is a huge cost.
And so absolutely, like, I think the other thing is that, importing those insects, they aren't necessarily to the same standards as the insects that are farmed here that have some regulations, you know, from the FDA. So those crickets probably came from somebody's agricultural field. And so although like I support the foraging efforts of these people and they deserve money for it, and I hope they can build an industry, the quality control is a lot more difficult on our end for that.
Absolutely. I'm pretty sure that Oyamel is a Jose Andreas restaurant. And so, I love the importation of the Oaxacan recipe. Given this story, obviously there's an example of a place where crickets and tacos is just another protein source. You obviously have tacos made out of many other sources. But right, why couldn't the crickets themselves be locally sourced?
The other thing that your comment made me think of, and one thing that I think really helps kind of conceptualize the sustainability of insects, is that, okay, we're omnivores, meaning we need plant matter and animal matter in order to most easily get all of our nutrients. So plants directly get the energy that we get from them that comes from the sun. But then to eat that animal part, you need to eat an animal that ate the plants. And then, so if you're eating the insects, you're eating the very low base scale, the first animal to eat that plant. Once you start eating animals that are higher up the food chain, you are now like distorting it, like that we had to plant a lot of corn in order to feed these large animals. But like when you're working with those insects, you're working at that one-to-one, you know, conversion ratio. You're eating the plant and you're eating the animal that most efficiently converts that plant to energy for us. You're at the bottom of the food chain, and that's going to be the most sustainable option across the board.
Okay. So I have another question for you, because this idea of eating the insects that are our pests, it sounds really good. But again, just so we're clear. So my disgust factor is going off pretty hard for things that are rather pestilent, like mosquitoes or fleas. Mm-hmm. These are bugs that their pestilence, right, is kind of legendary, if you want to go like plague or malaria. These are just coming to mind. Are those insects, do people eat them? Do non-human primates eat them? Can we clean them? Are they always scary because these guys eat blood? Discuss.
Right. mosquitoes, I know mosquito eggs are consumed.
Okay. Yeah. I think that's the first time my disgust has gone off in this conversation, which I'm proud of, but oh man.
Really? That was it. That was the tipping point. Those would be say, you know, like, so yeah, to eat a mosquito, I think is a terrible idea because they are pests to mammals, which means they then carry the blood and, you know, so then you're technically eating what that other animal as well. And so zoonotic diseases clearly are going to transfer more closely, you know, if you're
absolutely, yeah.
So I think mosquitoes,
good thing for everyone to remember.
Yeah. So I think eating whole, and I can't say for sure they're not consumed somewhere, but they're also like, I don't exactly know how that would work, like catching them and preparing them. So they might be consumed somewhere, but I would say that's probably pretty low on my list of insects that I think people should really take advantage of. But skimming their eggs off of water, again, is pest control.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, you're right. Like the logical part of me sees it.
Yeah.
And then the, you know, like you talked about earlier, the disgust part of me is like, oh, there it is.
Yeah.
There it is for me.
Yeah,
I'll eat a butterfly. I'll eat a weevil.
Yeah.
I don't even know what a weevil is.
Your strong disgust, though, was against insects that are directly pests to us and not pests to our plants. And those probably, if they are biting people, like fleas or mosquitoes, those they are going to be carrying human blood in them, and those are probably not the ones we should be eating. So the range of your disgust was correct there. Like, disgust is there to protect
you. Thank you for validating my disgust. Yeah. I mean, right. That absolutely makes sense. I know that mosquitoes and fleas carry disease, as my question indicated. So to think of them as food, even if we could, in theory, you know, give them clean sources of animal protein from animals that we would eat otherwise, I mean, it does close the gap. But just, yeah, you know, so many sources and ways of the sustainability. I really think, yeah, I think the compost worms is a better way to go than the mosquito larvae, if we're going to go with closing the pest loop.
And the worms don't disgust you, though. You're okay. The worms aren't triggering.
Nope.
That's interesting.
Not me.
Yeah.
Not me. No, I'm fine.
Cool.
I mean, I don't know that I just want to, like, down them.
No.
You know.
Well, I think that's
raw.
Another thing, though, is... is in thinking about people's like disgust reactions, they often think about eating them raw and wiggling and moving. And yes, some people do that, but for the most part, they're just an ingredient in a dish that requires cooking and preparation and, you know, mixing and blending of ingredients to make it taste amazing. And that's true worldwide. So I think we have a very narrow kind of conception of what, like, fear factor has really ruined, you know, how people think about eating bugs, because they always give them these whole wiggling, you know, insects. But that's not how people eat on average.
Well, Julie, you know,
how much anthropology has suffered from TV is a conversation we have another time.
Well, yeah, but Julie, you're helping the fight back, you know, because you've really posed a lot of interesting questions, I think, both about the science of why we would have eaten bugs, why it makes sense, why it makes sense that we lost that knowledge over time, and why it makes sense that we bring it back, you know? Fear factor is none of those things. So your contribution is duly noted. Well, Julie, I just really enjoy that you are fighting back against the disgust factor, because you made a lot of good points about how it would make sense that insects would have been a helpful nutrition source, and that the onus really, you know, with their availability, their diversity, the diverse technologies that we could have used and taken advantage of, and then why we would have lost that knowledge through time, or at least through a particularly Eurocentric view of what food is. And I don't know, the argument to reclaim it now is also sound. The sustainability, like you said, the world does agriculture. And so we've confronted, you know, the insects and their relationships before, but we seem to have lost that knowledge on this part of the world. And that's unfortunate. I appreciate your work for sort of helping us understand that we can recondition that disgust, you know, for the betterment of ourselves.
That's a great way of putting it.
Yes, thank you. This was a great conversation.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, have a good day, everybody.
Yes, thanks again to everyone for joining us on our mini-series on edible insects. If you like this kind of mini-series where we do a number of episodes, have some guest hosts, guest conversations across them, let us know. And we can, you know, let us know what you want to hear and who you want us to talk to, and we will be happy to put them together. So we've been talking with Julie Lesnick, a biological anthropologist at Wayne State University in Michigan. You can check out her website at entomoanthro.org, or it's entomoanthro.org. She's got some great work, great resources on there, and you can look at an awesome new webcomic, web series she's making called Octopus and Ape that looks super cute and amazing. That's also ways of educating people about biological anthropology and the ways that we live in the world. Thanks for joining as always. Andrea Eller is guest hosting with us, and I'm Adam Gamwell. We'll see you next time.